You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Henri Cartier-Bresson established himself as one of, if not the most original and influential masters of photography, beginning in the 1930s. His body of work, a record of the human experience around the world from the 30s through the 60s, is the subject of the first retrospective in the U.S. in over 30 years. Henri Cartier-Bresson, The Modern Century, is on view at the Museum of Modern Art from April 8th. That's just, tomorrow?
It's on view for members of the museum now through Saturday, and then to the public from the 11th, which is Sunday.
And that'll run through June 28th. And I'm very pleased that it brings the man you just heard, Peter Galassi, chief curator in the Department of Photography at MoMA, and also the photographer Martine Franck, who is Cartier-Bresson's widow, to our show today. Welcome. Peter, Cartier-Bresson's photographs from the 30s remain some of the most recognizable in modern photography. Did he have that incredible eye from the start?
Pretty quickly. I mean, he wanted to be a painter and was trained as a painter, and then discovered his talent in photography. Obviously, it didn't happen overnight, but it happened pretty quickly.
And how did he get started as a photographer?
In the period after the war, First War, photography was sort of fluttering around the margins of all the different artistic movements, and so it wasn't surprising that a young, ambitious kid would try out photography and then discover.
And how was his work received in the 30s? Did it become immediately influential?
There wasn't a photography world in the 30s. Photography wasn't an art yet, really. And so there was a tiny international elite, European and American, and that did recognize the artistic potential of photography. And there, yes.
He was also changing the approach of photographers, wasn't he, Martin? He was working with small cameras like Leicas. Photographers in those days largely worked with those big box cameras.
They did indeed. It was when he came back from his trip to Africa that he discovered the Leica. And as he said, he'd started prowling the streets of Marseille with his Leica.
And that allowed him more freedom and allowed him to capture that special moment.
And spontaneity, I think, yes, it was a question of liberty and spontaneity.
Peter, did he come up with the phrase, the decisive moment?
It was the title of the American edition of his great book that had a French edition as well.
But the French
title was Image à la Sauvette. And Sauvette is a word that is used for illicit street traders who might have to run away at any moment if the police arrive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same point, except that it's much more of an in-joke, I guess, for the French. But I like the decisive moment. That really does seem to describe what he was about. Martin, did he share his secret for capturing just the right moment with you?
Well, you know, he never claimed this as being one of his great specialities, the decisive moment. I mean, I think he was much more imaginative in a way. You know, he was right into reality, but he was also a dreamer, I think.
But anybody who's taken photographs knows that you often miss that perfect shot, and he always seemed to get the perfect shot. And I always wondered how he focused the camera so quickly. Did he have a special technique for doing that?
I think he was just very, very, very quick.
How did he meet Robert Capa? That was a key thing for him, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. They met in Paris in the late 30s when they were both photo reporters for the same newspaper.
And Capa persuaded him to call himself a photojournalist?
This was after the war.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. He had been called a little surrealist photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't strike me particularly as a surrealist.
The work of the early 30s was very much surrealist in spirit. And then he was a completely independent artist. He wasn't working for anybody. Then it was after the war, when he joined up with Capa and a couple of other friends to found Magnum, that's when Capa said to him, throw away this surrealist stuff, you'll get lost.
Do you think, Martin, that change in his style made him less creative?
No,
or
not
creative
at all.
Did he have to become creative in a different way?
Well, I think, yes, he did change after the war. I mean, he was prisoner of war for 3 years. And I think, obviously, that changed his mentality, his whole outlook towards the world. But also, I think, after World War II, people wanted to find out what the world was like. They'd been confined by the war, and it was the golden age of photojournalism. And he really traveled. If you see those big maps that Peter blew up for us with all his travels, it's very, 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 very surprising.
Going out there to show just the terrible things that happened in the aftermath of the war everywhere.
And not just terrible things, but how the world was changing.
Mm-hmm. Now, why had he been a prisoner of war for 3 years?
Well, when Germany and France declared war in September 1939, he was mobilized. He had his military training when he was younger. And then finally, when the war actually started between the French and the Germans, and the French army collapsed almost instantly, nearly 2 million French soldiers were taken prisoner by the Germans.
Martin, when did you meet him?
I met Henri in 1963.
So it was much later. Now, he'd already traveled a lot around the world.
Yes,
was he continuing to travel when you met?
Yes, he was continuing to travel, but less so. Yes, so he wanted to get back to drawing, in fact.
Mm-hmm. And he eventually did give up taking photographs?
No, he never gave up. He never gave up taking photographs. He continued taking portraits and landscapes right to the end. But he no longer did reportage. He no longer accepted
And what was his reason? He was the master of reportage. He was recognized around the world as, if not the greatest photographer of that style, one of the greatest. There's practically a whole school of Cartier-Bresson with a wide range of people in this country who all... Robert Frank, for example, was traveling around the United States around the same time that Cartier-Bresson was, and he obviously was very influenced by your late husband. Why would he want to give it up? Did it stop giving him pleasure?
Well, I think it was a question of age. It was a question also of there being less work.
You mean Life magazine went under and other magazines started disappearing?
Also, I think he wanted to settle down a bit, wanted to have a family. And, we'll ask Peter what he thinks. Why?
You know, this is what the maps show, that for 45 years he was almost never home. Mm-hmm. And as he put it, he said, you know, to be a photographer you have to have one eye, one finger, and two legs. Photography for him meant moving. It meant traveling, and he'd been traveling his whole life.
Did you do a lot of the traveling with him?
No, I didn't. No, we traveled to Russia together, but otherwise we didn't travel very often together.
Russia was
the Soviet Union, actually. It was.
Yeah, the communist countries were significant to him because he'd been a communist when he was young.
He was never a party member, but he was certainly very sympathetic towards the Communist Party.
Was he one of those people who felt that what he saw later was the light that failed? That was he disappointed, disillusioned by what he saw in the Soviet Union and, you know, under Stalin and then China under Mao?
Certainly, I think he was disappointed, yes. I mean, these were two countries he never wanted to go back to.
Mm-hmm. But he took some incredibly powerful photographs.
He made great photographs. I think for him, though, it wasn't his personal political convictions weren't the issue. It was that for a Western photographer to gain access to the Soviet Union or Communist China or eventually Cuba, which he also did, was a kind of journalistic coup. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just go there and work.
I'm assuming that they were pleased that a man who was considered one of the greatest photographers in the world wanted to come. On the other hand, I'm sure they were aware of the fact that he captured things on film that other people might not see.
That's a very complicated question.
My guests are Peter Galassi, Chief Curator in the Department of Photography at the Museum of Modern Art, and Martine Frank, who is a photographer and is Henri Cartier-Bresson's widow. The show Henri Cartier-Bresson, The Modern Century, will be running through June 28th, and we have a slideshow of photographs from the exhibit on our show page at wnyc.org. Many of the photos seem to work on a couple of levels. There's the immediate image that we see, and then when we look closer, we see other fascinating things, which would make for interesting photos in their own right. Was that something that he was specifically looking for, or were they just serendipity? Was that a goal, do you think? I mean, because it happens so often in these photos. You think you're seeing something, a street scene that where a certain thing is happening, and then, for example, a man is pushing a wheelbarrow, and then you see that there's a nude boy inside the cart.
Well, it's in this. Did he want his pictures to have the richness of life? Yes. Was it a calculated notion of exactly how people would discover the pictures? I don't think so. It was maybe simultaneously a person who was extremely well informed, very intelligent, very observant of other people, of all different kinds of people. But when he released the shutter, it was pure instinct. It wasn't an intellectual calculation.
What we wind up with is a lot of pictures that we can almost use the word iconic to describe. For example, I wonder, what is it about that picture of people picnicking along a river, Juvisy, France, from 1938, that makes it just so memorable? It's just people sitting alongside the river. And there are a lot of pictures like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that particular picture, there are the four people who are complete individuals. It's four different shapes who are sitting next to each other. It's extremely articulate. And you notice there's no horizon in the picture. At the top of the picture is just the water. And so it encloses them in this complete world.
He seemed to know everyone, or at least took pictures of everyone. When was he friends with most of the people that he took those portraits of, Martine?
He certainly became friends with them. I mean, he was always interested in painting. He was very interested in literature. And so he enjoyed all his life taking portraits of intellectuals. And he worked a lot with Vogue and with Harper's Bazaar. He had a contract with them, actually, to do portraits. But he often suggested people he would like to go and photograph because he admired them. He only photographed people he really liked.
Didn't he become something of a celebrity in his own right?
Yes, he did. I think he did. He resented it, but he did.
And what about the pictures that suddenly took on a life of their own, like the smiling boy carrying two bottles of wine in Paris, which became really popular? Was he surprised when that sort of thing happened?
You know, this was one of the pictures that he really disliked, maybe because it became so famous.
It's kind of sentimental in a way.
It is. That's what he resented at the end. He thought it was too sentimental.
Peter, in the catalog, you write about a picture he took of President Jackie Kennedy, of Jackie Kennedy. Was it Jackie Kennedy?
Mm-hmm.
What's the story behind that? It was written here, President Jackie Kennedy, and I actually read what was written. I knew his name was Jack.
I don't actually know the story behind it, but it's on Inauguration Day, and President Kennedy and Jackie are in the open limousine, presumably driving from the Capitol to the White House. And Cartier-Bresson is clearly on along the parade route, along with millions of other photographers. All taking pictures. And you see in the picture that she is in the process of recognizing him and pointing him out to the president. So so obviously the picture reveals that they had a relationship.
And what about the others? We mentioned all these portraits: Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, Henri Matisse, Alberto Giacometti, Coco Chanel, William Faulkner, Truman Capote, all famous photographs. Did he know these people, or was he just taking them on assignment?
Sometimes he knew them. Sometimes he was taking them on the assignment. Sometimes he continued the relationship.
And none of them seemed posed. But he, I mean, they were aware that that Henri Cartier-Bresson was there with a camera.
You know, he always said that the basis of a portrait was actually a conversation, that he never posed people. He never asked a person to sit in a certain place or look at him. On the contrary, I think he tried often to avoid eye contact with the person he was photographing.
He captured two important political transformations, China before the communist takeover in 1948 and India in the last days of Mahatma Gandhi's life and then the days after his assassination. Did he just happen to be in the right place at the right time? Why was he in China at the time right before Chiang Kai-shek was forced to flee?
After he and Kappa and the others had founded Magnum in the middle of 1947, he left for Asia. Their idea was that they would have a handful of photographers who more or less cover the world. And his initial area was Asia, where, as he said it, the World War actually changed Asia more than it changed the U.S. and Europe. And in fact, the whole area was in transformation. The British Empire there was collapsing, and India and Pakistan had just come into being. Indonesia was becoming independent, Burma, and then, of course, the revolution in China. And so without knowing that the communists were yet going to win when he left, he knew that this area was changing in extraordinary ways, and that's why he had gone. He had met members of Nehru's family here in New York in 1946 before he left, and this is how he got access to photographing Gandhi.
And he had this picture in which Nehru is laughing in a way that I was very undignified. I never would have thought he would. I mean, no other photographer has ever captured Nehru in just that way. He went back to China for the Great Leap Forward in 1958. And there's a photo of men selling crickets in straw cages beneath a modern billboard for sneakers, another one of those juxtapositions. You say he wasn't looking for those?
I think he liked to be taken by surprise. I think he was looking for them, but there was an intuition. I don't think he was.
He also wrote captions for.
He wrote extensive captions, yes.
Did he think the Great Leap Forward was a good idea?
I don't think so, no.
No, I don't think so.
Well, in retrospect, it was an awful thing. Mm-hmm. He went back to the Soviet Union in 1970. Was he surprised by how much it had changed? Or had it changed?
Well, there, Martine was with him.
Yes, there was with him. Yes, he was surprised by how much it was changed, yes, certainly. Well, and, of course, he traveled much more in 1972 than he did when he first went.
He traveled more the first time.
No, the second time.
He was given more freedom?
I don't know if he had more freedom, but because we were accompanied continually by an interpreter and guide. And
how much time did he spend in America? I mentioned he was traveling around the country around the same time that Robert Frank was shooting The Americans. And it's amazing how, since I guess they're both Europeans, how similar their Americas are, even though they are very different photographers.
I think he photographed in the U.S. more than any other country except France. And yes, of course, he also showed the same country that Robert Frank showed. And of course, them both being Europeans, America was appalling. Its vulgarity and shallowness and chasing after money and so forth.
None of which is true.
No, of course not. but actually, I think the subject matter shows up in both of their pictures. But actually, I think Robert Frank's pictures are great because they're emotional. And Cartier-Bresson's pictures are great because they strive for neutrality.
I was struck by how different from Paul Strand's his images of Mexico were. I guess they represent two different strains of photography.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he missed taking pictures at all when he stopped traveling as much?
No, I don't think he missed it, no. No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. But it had been his life.
Yes, yes, it was his life. But he was on to other things. He was.
I've never seen the drawings and paintings. Have they ever been exhibited?
Yes, they have. Yes, he was actually. A lot of people don't like his drawings and paintings and regret very much that he slowed down on his photography.
Hmm.
But it was his choice. So.
He always said, and to the frustration of photography lovers, that he was never interested in photography as such. I think he meant it, and I believe him. What he was interested in was the world, and photography was his way of being out in the world.
But these pictures are so beautiful in their own right, and there's all sorts of stuff with light and composition that it just doesn't happen because you're interested in the world. He had
this great talent, too.
I'm assuming that there are an awful lot of negatives that still have never been printed. Is that true?
Well, you know, when you look at his contact sheets, he edited them very carefully. And those that he edited, most of them have been printed at one time or another. And what's interesting in the show, I think, is that a lot of, well, practically all these photographs that Peter selected were distribution prints from Magnum. And these were prints that were made at the time of the actual traveling. So,
and some of them, he printed his own photos in the early days, but then later he had he just sent them back to Magnum and other people printed them for
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple of cases, you even have, you compare his print with a later print.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, because the older ones actually aren't in such good shape. And I looked at it and I thought, gee, my teacher would have yelled at me for not using enough hypo.
No, they're in very good shape. It was just printed very light from the beginning. It hasn't changed.
Do you think that Cartier-Bresson is still an influential photographer today?
Peter, do you see
his influence in young photographers?
Well, not. I mean, his influence on photography is in the bloodstream of the. It's like trying to pull out one chemical that's in your blood. It's been in the bloodstream of photography for more than half a century. So it would be impossible to pull it out. But yes, I think he's still a touchstone for a lot of photographers.
And do you see in his work the photographers who influenced him?
That's a very different. There were very few photographers who influenced him because there was no established photographic tradition.
But there were some pretty great photographers.
Yes.
Fritz Ache, for example.
Ache, André Kertész, Martin Munkácsy. There were specific people who influenced him. But the tradition was just in the process of forming.
Meanwhile, we have this magnificent show with photographs, prints, and also many of the magazine layouts that were done from his photographs, these large maps. And it is a fascinating exhibit. I'm amazed that it's been so long between retrospectives. Was MoMA tempted before, or was it just too difficult to pull this off?
Oh, well, I actually think that, you know, sort of once a generation is probably about the right pace.
You know that MoMA has actually organized four exhibitions around Henri's work, which is enormous. I don't think there are many photographers who've had that privilege. And I think it's the Americans, in fact, who really discovered Henri. He always said, it's thanks to the Americans that I'm well known.
When will we see an exhibit of your work, Martine?
I shall be exhibiting in Tokyo in August.
Well, I'll be sure to come.
and you have a new book about to come out.
Yes.
Well, you want to tell us about it?
Well, the new book that's coming out is actually, it's a book that's on women, and it will be a show in Tokyo. And I'm currently working on foreign artists who've chosen to work in Paris, and I'm working in their studios.
Meanwhile, we have this exhibit, Henri Cartier-Bresson, The Modern Century, which goes on view April 11th and runs through June 28th at the Museum of Modern Art. We also have a slideshow. You can get a sense of what you'll find at the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. I want to thank Martine Frank and Peter Galassi for being our guests today on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.